We are interviewing today David Daniel, author of Seven Star Bird, winner of the 7th annual Levis Reading Prize here at VCU. We're very glad to have him here as a visitor and as the winner of the prize. And he's being interviewed by myself, Gregory Donovan, and David Wojahn. David, this is a book which focuses on some actual historical events and actual real-world places, although it does so, I suspect, after reading the book carefully, with a lot of imaginative flair and freedom as well. Yeah. I kind of wanted to know a little bit about some of the backgrounds to the book. We have this book that is rooted in the story of Friendship, Texas, a Moravian town, perhaps not anything many readers might ordinarily think about when they think about Texas. And I have a feeling that's kind of exactly your point.
It is. The place itself was just a small farming community, and it was filled with these Czech farmers. You know, they spoke Czech, they drank Czech, they did everything Czech, except they had the big hats and they had the guns in the back of the pickups and the boots. So it was a very odd way to grow up. The church was Moravian there. So I was there during the summers, and it was just a spectacularly sort of unified culture in the midst of this enormous state, of course, comprising many other of these little cultures. Just down the street, there was a German one all over, and they're still there today. There's actually a town that's about 10 miles away from Friendship that's one building, a post office, and there's a little general store, and then there's this enormous beer hall filled with these women in sort of the classic German barmaid outfits. And I don't know where the people come from, but it's obviously would hold 200, 300 people. So there are these sort of odd things, and they're all of course immigrants who come in and just sort of refuse to give it up or try not to for as long as they can before they're taken over. And in this case, in the late 60s, the state decided to flood it in order to protect the richer town south along the San Gabriel River. That's when my grandmother became very active in fighting the dam, and she ended up being the last person to sell, she and my grandfather. Because of that, of course, the property values had decreased by about 80%, so she got 20% of what her neighbors got 5 years before. So it was just a very horrible thing to watch as a kid in a place that had been very special to me. It was sort of we moved around a lot when I was a child, and so this was sort of my imaginative home. You know, suddenly it was underwater when I was about 13.
At what point in the writing of the book did you realize you had to include the friendship sequence? When did you know that you needed to include that sequence of friendship poems in it?
I think about 10 years ago, I realized that in all the poems, before I started writing these specific poems about friendship, that most of them seem to have been sort of guided by this metaphor of flooding or a sense of displacement, a sense of homelessness. The notion of immigrants leaving Moravia because of religious and economic persecution, coming to the U.S. and then being pushed around and then now dispersed across the country. And it just seemed to be a part of the way that I was looking at the world. And then it seemed to me, as I began writing the poems, to become something that had to do with not just this particular group of Americans, but with many of us, as we just sort of have all just dispersed and lost any real sense of home, at least it's been my experience.
Well, it's a pretty funny irony that you have a community based on faith that gets, gets knocked out by something that's almost the equivalent of a biblical flood.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you have linked that longing and sense of loss of, as you put it, imaginative home, and clearly what for many people, and in some sense must have been for you, a spiritual home. And that motif links up with another kind of mourning that's going on in the book, a much more personal mourning. There's this speaker in these poems who is mourning a lost wife. Yeah. How did that begin to interplay, and how did that arise?
I think that initial sense of loss, this is based on an actual woman, not my wife, but a woman I was in love with who died of leukemia very early. And I think that sense of loss was my first really clear one. It seemed to be a bridge from sort of childhood to a sort of adulthood at that moment. And that loss, and I was always an elegiac kid, but that was something that really sort of focused my images and focused my feelings. And then as that sense of loss sort of became less personal and more sort of countrywide, as I began to sort of spread out and see this everywhere. So it was sort of my first, the first significant personal loss that just sort of seemed to make sense with connecting the losses of my childhood with the losses that were coming ahead.
there's quite a spiritual backdrop to all of this, particularly as relates to the Moravian Church. That's kind of what makes it more obvious. But there's also a philosophical conduit going on here, the background of Heraclitus and the background of Kabbalah. Do you have a special interest in those?
I do. I love all of that stuff. And it's been with me since I was a child, an interest in all of the sort of odd sects. Growing up in the South as I did, you're a place filled, of course, with churches. And I was next door to an African-American church that was filled with the singing all of the time. So it was all just very much a part of my growing up. And I feel like since I was a kid, I never really felt like I belonged where I was. And so I was always interested in these oddballs, whether it was Kabbalah or in any of the various characters that, who've explored sort of non-traditional religious experiences. And that continues to be something I'm fascinated with. And Heraclitus seems to me someone who spoke to me very directly about this sense of loss, of placelessness, of a sense of a kind of longing. The early Greek tragedies, especially Oedipus, had another sort of profound religious effect on me, in the sense of just sort of beginning to understand a force that was so great as to crush us all, despite our greatness, as we think, and sensing that really nothing, he didn't do anything really that wrong, except for maybe murdering his father. But everything else, he did exactly what he should have done to avoid the destiny that was allotted him. And he still ends up, of course, wrecked and ruined. And when I first read that, I mean, it's a very funny play to me. And I think that when I first hooked up with that play, I felt like that became, again, the sort of the conduit through which I began to understand both the humor and the loss became a less personal loss there as I began to see it. If it can happen to Oedipus, God knows, you know, what's going to happen to me or any of us.
Like Greg, I guess it would be reductive to give you a label to your poems, but I think I'd have to call them, I guess, devotional poems and elegies. And, you know, you have that epigraph in one of the sections from Solon, who seems to me like the premier devotional poet of the century. But I remember being a little bit puzzled by this blurb on the back of the book where Harold Bloom compares your writing to Crane. And I remember when I first read the book, it just, your style seemed so much less ornate than Crane's. But in reading it again, it seemed that it was an apt connection, simply because you seek something that, you know, that spindrift gaze towards paradise that Crane always aspired to, desire to make the terrestrial holy. And this desire, I guess, is most abundantly seen in the title poem. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the title poem, because it seems almost an ars poetica, the key to reading everything else in the book.
It is. It was a poem that originally was worked on for about a year and a half, and it was maybe 35 or 40 scattered pages of stuff. And I thought that I had just wasted 2 or 3 years. And I knew that it was important, but there was just no form to it. And as I began to sort of finish up the rest of the manuscript, I began to realize that it was, in a sense, I began to be able to look at all that stuff, knowing that it was in some ways the key to how I understood the rest of the book as coming together. So I was able then to sort of focus in and to sort of piece it together. It was a sort of a purposeful edit, which was unusual for me. It wasn't really poetic so much as it was something that I understood at a larger scale because I had the book, something I hadn't just never thought of in terms of the architecture of it before. And then all the bits and pieces, the voice was there for the various bits and pieces of the book to sort of come together. And I hadn't experienced that before. You know, I seemed to otherwise, the poems either started out as a more straight lyric or they started out as a prose poem, and they more or less stayed within that diction and that syntax. And with this poem, I felt like a door had opened where I could sort of throw it all together. It's also, to me, the door for the next book as well. Sort of picks up more on that style.
I think that's something a lot of people don't realize, is that, especially, like, let's say, poets who are starting out, they understand and eventually come to learn their own compositional process, and they begin to learn where the sources of their poems are and what subject matter is going to attract them. And as they start to put that all together into a book, that emerges ever more clearly. But the thing that I discovered is the same thing you are narrating, that you discovered, is that at some point the book itself can call out for a poem to be written that draws things together.
I think so. I felt desperate. It was a way to sort of make sense of a number of years of writing poems. And I think also combined with that was a number of years of teaching and being almost completely immersed in poems, so that they began to speak and to sort of help me. It wasn't just me sort of trying to understand the poems, but it was what I had learned and all the other poets that were speaking to me that show up in the epigraphs or wherever. It was a sense of something being whole as opposed to just being these scattered moments, which I knew were related but didn't know exactly how.
You also talk about, in that title poem, you talk about Luria directly, and you talk about that Kabbalistic notion that at the beginning of the world, what's it called? Zimzum?
Yes.
That God concentrated himself, and it's a very interesting concept, isn't it? And sort of withdrew from the world and focused himself into sort of this piercing light. So it's another version of let there be light, but it's a way more mystical.
Yes, yes.
Is that something you were, that's what you were feeling like?
I think so. The sense of abandonment, also the sense of the that there is, although this world seems to me related to some world of significance, whatever God we have is clearly not too concerned about this particular place, although there seem to be elements of it sort of sparkling through. And so that withdrawal, which allows our world to be created with its flaws, with its beauties, is what was really important to me, which again seemed to me to correspond to the fact of these waters pouring in, taking over the city, this town, and forcing them, you know, the positive side is forcing them out into the larger culture, which itself is, you know, beautiful. It's Oedipus wandering in the end, blind, but still wandering, you know, and moving on. So that was my sense of it. My interest really in the Gnostics and the Kabbalah's off is really more aesthetic. I really love the images. I love the thing that I stole about the souls going up into the moon is, you know, is straight out of Valentine. It's just the idea that the moon, as it gains light, as it waxes, is just the souls, the light, the pneuma, the spark that's going up there before it gets drifted up into the next place, and then it empties out again. It's lovely stuff. And so that's why when I'm reading that stuff, more than anything, I'm shopping for stuff that just sort of seems to fit into my views.
You know, it's funny, I mean, this is a sideline, but how much American poetry has been influenced by Gnostical thinking and Kabbalah in the last, like, 20 or 30 years. I think of, say, somebody like Brenda Hillman, who you can't understand her work without, you know, reading the Nag Hammadi Library.
Right.
Or Charles Wright, very much someone else. I think you put your finger on it, where it's just the terrific aesthetic appeal of some of those writings, and the fact that they're fragmented already. It's just been, I think, a real source of inspiration for a whole generation of American writers, and somebody should really do a lot more thinking about it.
Yeah, I agree. Bloom has a book called The American Religion. Have you seen that? Which sort of talks about the Gnostic.
Connects that to Joseph Smith and people.
Absolutely. I agree with him, and I feel like it has been, especially with Southerners, you know, and Charles, of course, has been in the thick of it in Pickwick Dam. You know, certainly, I think if you were seeing any of that primitive stuff still there, he's tapping into it. And I feel like it's certainly part of my culture. But yeah, it has become very, well, now of course we have Madonna.
Right. Well, you know, it taps into an American kind of paranoia too, because the whole concept of Gnosticism is that false gods made the world, and it's been, you know, a complete whitewash. And, you know, during the time of the Bush administration, it makes perfect sense to think that the powers that be are ones that are completely delusional.
Yes, absolutely.
But there are better powers that be beyond that.
Yes.
That they don't know about.
Right.
Well, you know, that's interesting that... You're obviously drawing the circle that draws other narrow sectarian interests. You know, they draw maybe tight circles around themselves, but I think that's characteristic of American poets. And, you know, we really kind of, I'm not saying anything new when I say we get that out of Emerson, really, but it's a long-standing tradition in American poetry to be deeply religious without being sectarian. You know?
Right.
At the same time, there are, and because of that, maybe is the way I should say this. This is a book which in some ways strikes me as a deeply Christian book. It's a book that also strikes me, and I hope this doesn't strike you as odd, as a very Jewish book because of, the opening epigraph, which says, open the door of the book, you know. And you take that metaphor quite literally in a number of poems. I mean, it can't be literal, but I mean, you play with it as an extended metaphor that you... work with, and the people of the book, you know, idea that is playing around here, and also the idea of displacement, exile, loss.
Very much so. I mean, that I feel a great kinship with that story, with that destiny, with the illusions. The illusion of Israel to some degree, and now the reality of it, and the ironies to some degree of trying to make a place, embody that imaginative place. I find these things very, very beautiful, and certainly that's just, it seems to have always been a part of my thinking. I was also thinking too that there's a love in every major world religion. There's always a mystical aspect in every one that we know of. Those people are always the freaks. They're the outsiders. They are, you know, the Rumis. They're sort of, you know, whirling around some corner in the very unofficial corners of the religion. Same with Kabbalah. But always, it seems too, that the people in the mainstream are singing the songs, reading the poems, dancing the dances of those outsiders. You know, so they still, even if they're not officially acknowledged, they become a part of things. And I think, again, sort of sensing the connection too with the writers writing about these things, it just makes sense. We are the people on the outside hoping to somehow penetrate from our unofficial position, because I feel like the force is there, whatever's in everyone. But yeah, I mean, I think that you're talking about this being a Christian book. You know, there's no doubt those are my symbols. You know, the Judeo-Christian tradition is just what I am most comfortable with, what I grew up with, and they come very, very naturally to me, even though I don't consider myself particularly a Christian poet. I mean, a Christian.
Well, that whole notion of elegy and diaspora there throughout the book, and I was thinking about that in light of another poem that seems to me a real linchpin in the collection is Elegy. In Two Storms, mm-hmm. which seems to be a kind of, and almost in the way that the title poem speaks for the spiritual longing of the book, that the Elegy in Two Storms speaks for that kind of elegiac temperament that kind of also commingles with the spiritual one. So I wonder if you could talk about that poem a little.
Oh, sure. I've got to think about that poem for a little bit. This is a kind of an old one, and it was certainly one based on very particularly the woman I mentioned before. And this was written actually, and I lived in a beautiful farm in Crozet, Virginia, overlooking the mountains. And so there was a goldfinch, and the goldfinch would actually take a dandelion tuft and eat it from my hand. And somehow, it was just after this woman had died that I'm looking at the Blue Ridge, which is really sort of, that's another place that's really my home. The combination of those things seemed so poignant to me that I was able, I felt like, to sort of get her. Not as the individual, but as the sort of spiritual representative. Mm-hmm. It was a hugely important poem, and also it was weaving this sense of longing with a very real landscape, which at the time I was having difficulty doing. And so the sort of the more supernatural stuff was beginning to sort of come together in a way that seemed more convincing to me, and a little bit less self-indulgent maybe than some of the other poems about that have to do with her.
I recently had a discussion, I heard a bunch of young poets talking about how tired they were of the elegiac mode and that they saw running through so much contemporary poetry, and they were very adamant in this desire to try to write poems of celebration and poems of joy, poems that, you know, tried to extol the virtues of daily life. Mm-hmm. You know, they talked about O'Hara specifically as their guide in this goal. And, you know, I just found myself shaking my head. Partly it's because I think O'Hara is very much a poet of heartbreak rather than a poet of celebration. And also because I kept wondering if there was any substance to that complaint. And I thought there wasn't, but, you know, I guess I just wondered why American poets are so preoccupied with melancholy, with mourning. Why that's the part of the Romantic tradition that we seem to have inherited.
It's something I'm dealing with right now in a new book I'm working with. It's really trying to question the aesthetic upon which many of the poems in this book were based on, even sort of unconsciously. The things we've inherited, which are the persistence, in my view, of a romantic aesthetic, really, going back to a Keats and a Shelley. I think we adopt a diction, we adopt a tone, we adopt a lot of things that seem to be, this is what poetry is. Mm-hmm. And I've been surprised looking back about how much, you know, since those days, the poetry is about death, very specific, or even a personal sense of loss. And wondering, in the face of people like O'Hara, and I agree with you, he does seem like a poet of heartbreak, but there is celebration there. There is a freedom from that diction, from that aesthetic that I appreciate. And we see, of course, in Ginsberg and some of those characters. And I've really begun to question some of to raise the same question to myself that you raised, and try to shift on something that doesn't look for, that really questions something like the Stevens is, you know, the death is the mother of all beauty. Something I think that many of us, you know, have sort of just taken on faith. I'm not convinced, and I'm trying in the new work to sort of go, okay, where do we go from here? This is to me the book about the past. I'm looking forward to a book that is more about the present, that is more about what are the restorative aspects after a book of elegy that one can provide. And I'm not convinced. I mean, the book is almost finished, and it still seems really elegiac. So I don't know. My sense of it was that there was this notion that this book ends with love is sort of the solution, and the sun being able to make out of the mess of stars some order and something that was outside of us and not sort of focused inward. But I'm just not convinced that I can do it. So I don't know.
Woody Allen's a pretty funny guy, and he ended up deciding there were only two subjects, love and death. You know,
so yeah, yeah, yeah. Well,
maybe it's an escape.
And the thing is, the more I write about love, the more I write about death. I can't seem to do it. And they're all filled with dark jokes, too, which is a...
I almost think, like, well, in a certain sense, if the situation is that we can never escape that in some manner, then the question really becomes, okay, how do you deal with making that... the subject of death large enough to encompass humor and graciousness and ridiculousness and absurdity.
Right.
And you do that in a number of your poems here, I think. I think particularly in the prose poems, there's an entire section of your book, the prose poems, and you adopt very seriously introduced with an epigraph from Paul Celan.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, there's a great deal of humor and whimsy and absurdity in that, which seems to me to be a strategy you employ to get away with subject matter that might be seen by some people as really being quite sentimental.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt. And I think that maybe the answer for me for now with dealing with this sort of elegiac aesthetic is not having to change it so much is to sort of unhitch some of the baggage of diction, the baggage of imagery that just sort of came along with this package, again, unconsciously, so that the poems can be opened up to more the more prosaic, the more hilarious, the stranger. That those prose poems seem to be a place where I was beginning to sort of shake it up a little bit, although I don't feel like they, until recently, that the aspects of those poems have been really melded well with the other aesthetic.
Well, I hear echoes of people who we associate with the prose poems in those poems, like people like Tate, a lot of the neo-surrealist writers.
Edson was an
Edson. But then it also seems to me that if I could think of anybody whose voice I hear more than anyone else's in the book, is James Wright's. And Wright, too, was a writer who had to deal with the whole issue of having created, almost encapsulized, a kind of the whole romantic aesthetic of the last 200 years in miniature with the image. But then he very much worked towards rejecting and refining and changing that aesthetic towards the end of his career, towards a more celebratory poem, I think.
Yes.
And convincingly so.
So my earliest memories of being a more adult poet was carrying around The Branch Will Not Break. Mm-hmm. For months through New York City, one summer, my special summer out of Tennessee, and sitting in Riverside Park, just, you know, weeping, and I memorized most of that book. It was an incredibly important book to me, and still admire tremendously a lot of those early poems. And so, but I've never thought of it having influence, but of course it would. I mean, it was some of the first sort of, you know, at the time he was a living poet, one of the first ones, yeah, I really latched onto and just sort of thought, well, this is, and it is to me a true American voice that he's beginning to, you know, to look for. And I think that's something that, although I certainly didn't understand at the time, it's what I'm working towards now. And I think it's, to some degree, also what Crane is doing, is the larger myth-making type poet.
Sometimes I think Americans find their most American voice by allowing themselves to be influenced by, say, South American influences or, you know, French influences, but mm-hmm. particularly maybe heading over towards the surrealism side of things or absurdity or something like that. And in the poem Paint, for example, in your book, the way that poem enacts these two people discussing something that's impossible to discuss, the eternal grievance of the dead against the living, which is that we're living, and how we carry that around with us, and how we have these dialogues with ourselves, representing the dead with ourselves as we speak for them. So yeah, it's a conversation between oneself and oneself, but not entirely, because you're still struggling to be fair to the other person, and maybe even let them accuse you of things. You know? And then in this poem, the thing that takes over that I really like so much is how in the end, they end up erasing each other. And so you seem to take on the idea of the danger of not only writing about the dead, but the danger of just the human emotional danger of just thinking about them at all, carrying them around with you all the time. I really like the combination of humor and sadness. And it's a nice balance between the two. It's done with great energy and humor. And I like the self-referential nature of it too. Throughout, where it's canceling itself out, it's making itself just. I really enjoyed that.
And these are certainly fun to write, and I'm sort of a quill type person. I have special things and very precious about all that. And at some point, I started writing these poems. I had an old Smith Corona typewriter that was like riding a lawnmower, and I would go and I would make these mistakes, and I would actually write into a typewriter, which was it was sacrilege. And yet somehow it opened up, for me a different world, a much less precious way of dealing with the same topics.
Do you think it's something having to do with the form of the prose poem that allows for those different tonalities, those shifts of diction that make it, that free people up in that respect?
It certainly has been the case for me. There's no question. And I think along with the influence of people like Russell Edson or Simic and Tate, there's a sense of freedom, just a sense of I can relieve myself of the pressures of thinking about this as being a poem. And like you say, I'm able to stretch out and put more conversational things in, which now you feel like I'm comfortable taking. I don't have to write a prose poem in order to get that into my poems anymore. And it is surprising. I can't just be the influence of these handful of people, but how many people writing prose poems seem to have that same experience? The poems do take on this quality. It's quite different from the other poems. It remains a sort of mysterious to me. And I think of that typewriter a lot, because there was something about engaging sort of the mechanical world, a sense of something that was a little bit, not particularly modern, but a little bit more modern than the pad and the pen, and that somehow shook me out of again more of those sort of inherited forms.
You don't always reserve that kind of surrealistic bent though for the prose poems. I mean, in a poem like Uncle Emmett, Wiser Than God, which, I mean, that's a funny title, right? I mean, it's just like, Emmett is bigger than God, and you better watch out, God. It reminds me one time of meeting a woman who was a Holocaust survivor, and I was having dinner with she and her sister. Both of them were Holocaust survivors. They were Hungarian Jewish women who had been through Dachau and several other camps. And it was the Day of Atonement, and while I was standing in the kitchen while this woman was making dinner, and I looked over at her, when the television announcer came on and said, "Today is the Day of Atonement," the Jewish announcer, and she laughed. She threw her head back and she laughed and she shook her fist at the sky, and you could see the tattoo on her arm. And she said, "Day of Atonement, God should atone to me." And I thought she had a right to say that.
Yeah.
She had some right to say that. And maybe these people from Friendship, Texas.
Maybe so.
That poem has this sense that there were these lovely eccentrics and this beautiful possibility, all of which was destroyed because God gave up,
right.
But they didn't.
Right, that's right. I love that thought of these people who didn't have children. This is actually a real couple, and sort of sensing that maybe that's why, because they knew that there was no future. And somehow there's some people who were sort of aware of their destiny, and in that sense, not allowing them to incur the loss, and in that way sort of outsmarting God, is my sense of it. It was a place, at least in my memory, full of characters.